Welcome to Breaking Doctrine, presented to you by the Combined Arms Doctrine Directorate at the Combined Arms Center at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. The views expressed here are those of the individual and do not represent the views of the Combined Arms Center, U.S. Army, or U.S. government.
Welcome to Breaking Doctrine, a U.S. Army Combined Arms Center podcast on emerging doctrine and the Army's vision of warfare. Hello, I'm Lieutenant Colonel Lisa Becker, and this podcast topic is the role of security force assistance in the Indo-Pacific theater. The doctrinal underpinnings for today's episode are FM3-22, Army Support to Security Cooperation, and ATP3-96.1, Security Force Assistance Brigade, or SFAB. Today, we welcome Colonel Brandon Teague, Commander of the 5th Security Force Assistance Brigade, and Lieutenant Colonel Eddie Callahan, the 5th SBAB Alpha Company Commander. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Hey, good morning, Lisa.
Morning.
Colonel Teague, could you tell listeners a little bit about the 5th SBAB, your background and what experiences or training helped you with your current positions?
Yeah, so the 5th Security Force Assistance Brigade is one of 5 active duty Security Force Assistance Brigades. There is one, the 54th SBAB is National Guard. But each one of the 5 active duty Security Force Assistance Brigades are regionally aligned to the combatant commands. So 5th is regionally aligned to the Indo-Pacific, where we are unique in we are assigned to the Indo-PACOM commander, and then we are operationally controlled by the United States Army Pacific Commander, General Flynn. And so that makes us unique. The other active duty SFABs are not the same to their COCOMs because of the unique situation that we have in the Indo-Pacific being the priority theater. The my background as a battalion commander, I did security force assistance in Iraq and Afghanistan. Afghanistan specifically as a battalion commander, where I was the senior advisor for the 203rd Corps for my 9 months that I spent there. That kind of opened my eyes to, you know, security force assistance. But then further along in my career, all SFAB commanders are 2-time brigade commanders. So I was a previous 3rd Brigade 101st Commander. And then I was General Flynn's executive officer for a year out in Hawaii and traveled extensively in the Indo-Pacific with him. And then I was the 1st Corps Chief of Staff, which is the one corps that is aligned to the Indo-Pacific Command. So that experience gained me a lot of insight into the Indo-Pacific and the partnerships that we have there, which I believe set me up for a lot of knowledge on the region. And so coming into this position, I felt confident in my abilities.
So I've been in 16 years now. So talking about experience that sort of aligns with the SFAB. So when you're hired as a company commander, you're hired for your sort of tactical experience. What did you previously do? So as an engineer company commander, I spent my recent time on KD time with 1st Brigade 10th Mountain. And so we just did our recent deployment to Iraq over there. And so that was that transition period. So when I'm advising as a company commander, you're working with brigades and divisions. So that's the experience that, like, short-term, this is what I have experience-wise. Like, long-term-wise, my previous deployment to Afghanistan, I was a mobile training team leader where I worked with out in Herat, where I worked with like engineer regiments out there to like do ground clearance and clearing of UXOs and stuff like that.
Awesome. Thanks, gentlemen. Because the SFAB is the only dedicated conventional force for conducting security force assistance, or SFA, I'd like to start the conversation by talking just in general about SFA before we dive into the actual SFAB. According to doctrine, SFA is Department of Defense activities that support the development of the capability and capacity of foreign security forces and their supporting institutions. I'd love it if you guys could help listeners really understand what that definition means.
Yeah, I think starting with, you know, we are built for war time. So I think a lot of people, when they think security force assistance, they think in competition, but really, we are a conflict-built organization. So that being said, you know, security force assistance takes on different flavors, obviously, throughout the spectrum of conflict. So whether we're, you know, in competition now, and shifting to crisis and then conflict. That we say we do four things in security force assistance in the SFAB. We advise, we support, we liaise, and we assess our partner forces. And that, depending on where we are in the spectrum of conflict, will depend on which one or multiples of those four types of things that we will accomplish with our partner. In competition, we do a lot of assessing and advising our partner forces on a myriad of different things. And then, you know, it will transition as we go to crisis and or conflict. I would argue in conflict, we would do more liaising with higher headquarters because they're going to want a lot of information initially on what is happening on the ground with the partner force. And then we would be advising our partner forces to either execute operations in their country, but it giving them advice on types of things to do, and then trying to support them with potentially joint U.S. assets that could bring to bear should we be in that conflict with them.
When I was looking up the doctrine about security cooperation, you know, there's this huge like Venn diagram, and SFA is just like a small part of it within the diagram. So can you kind of talk, help listeners understand, okay, there's this big overarching security cooperation, SFAB is a part of it. What is it not? What are those all those other things that you kind of don't do?
Yeah, I think sometimes, a lot of times we get confused with special forces and what special forces do. With foreign internal defense. So we are partner in all the countries that we're in. Special Forces is there doing their specific mission with the special forces of said country that we're in. So in Mindanao, which is southern Philippines, Special Forces has been doing foreign internal defense in that area with the Philippine national forces for years, since the global war on terror started, because of the internal security threat that they have down there. So that is one misconception, is we get confused with, oh, you're just conventional special forces, but we're not. We partner with conventional forces only. So it is the biggest difference and misnomer that a lot of people have.
As I was reviewing the SFA and SFAB doctrine, there were two things that stuck out to me. One was that you absolutely need to build advisor relationships for SFA to be effective. In fact, FM 322 says that relationships are advisors' pacing items. At the same time, the doctrine feels transactional, probably because of the strategic impact of your work. Could you speak more to that dichotomy, or you can just tell me I'm off base?
So, to get after sort of the transactional feel, and I don't think that it's wrong in the way that it's worded in that way. And the reason why is like the trust is your access to influence. And so when you're talking about influence and that sort of like access and capabilities and capacity, like you have to build that trust so that you can then challenge their paradigm and how they think about stuff so that they potentially can change and grow. So as you live with them day to day, shoulder to shoulder, meals, training opportunities, that consistency with them slowly builds that trust. And then all of a sudden you can, at some point, you've built enough of that will or that sort of like exchange with them that you can challenge something that they're currently doing. Like, hey, why are you training this way? Why are you shooting this way? Or why are you employing your forces this way? And it gets them to make that leap on their own or through like sort of guided questions. But that's the sort of the transactional piece of it, is like, yes, it is about trust. But what that trust buys you is the ability to influence. And that influence is where we build the capacity and capabilities on sort of what the security force assistant is working with the traditional forces. That sort of helps me.
Yeah. Could you give an example?
So in my recent employment, I'm very new to the security force assistant sort of like the paradigm and thinking and understanding like that. So my recent employment was to Malaysia. And East Malaysia is on Borneo. And so we worked in a state called Sabah. The United States has not operated out of that area very much. So there's not a lot of like sort of institutional knowledge about working with the United States. So when we get there, like there was very little guidance. It says, okay, build a relationship, find out what they want to work on, and then advise. I mean, that's pretty much the sort of like the level of sort of broad aperture of like that you have when you're going over to Borneo. in East Malaysia. And so when we first meet, sit down with your partners, like, okay, what do you want? Like, what do you want to get out of this relationship that we're building right here? And they talk about things they're working on. And so this is all built into like the sort of operational pathways, sort of like through an effort that USERPAC employs forces into the Indo-PACOM theater. So Operation Pathways was going to actually come to Sabah in a little over a year. So we said, okay, we want to understand, like, how you think, how do you plan, how do you employ forces? And so part of that is us sharing how we do it, and they share us how they do it. And we work towards bridging that, coming closer together. So it's not just like sitting down and like over a piece of paper and planning, but it's also sitting down over dinner and like talking about my family, talking about their families, like their cultural differences. Mm-hmm. And then it's as simple as like, hey, we're going to go play badminton on Saturday evening. Would you like to come play badminton with us? And so we'd go and we'd share those experiences with them. And eventually barriers start breaking down. Like they start talking about things that like they're struggling with inside of the Malaysian army, or like things they want to get better at. And like, so the particular thing they kept asking about was air assault operations. And it's like, okay, we can talk about that. I have plenty of experience with 1st 10th Mountain about mm-hmm. planning air assault operations. And so we started the LPDs at like division level. And then by the time my following forces, they were down at the tactical level with the platoon and company, like doing like loading drills and like planning, like what do you do when you embark on your aircraft and stuff like that. So that's sort of the, yes, it's transactional, but it's all about building that trust. That's the pacing thing. It's the people, mm-hmm. what is the pacing of it.
You know, but someone, what you were saying kind of struck me. So I worked with Afghans, and you know, you did too. Would you say that your work in the Indo-Pacific is a little bit different? Because in Afghanistan, we're wearing body armor. We're on these, you know, fobs or, you know, kind of confined spaces. It's hard. I thought it was harder to kind of break bread per se. Mm-hmm. Do you think it's easier when you don't, you're not in a combat zone?
Yeah. Yeah, it's different. I wouldn't say it's easier, but our persistent presence, and obviously we were persistent in Iraq and Afghanistan as well, but I think the difference in what we're doing in the Indo-Pacific and what we're doing in Iraq and Afghanistan is we were trying to build Afghan and Iraqi forces to be U.S. forces, and we are not trying to do that in the Indo-Pacific. We are trying to build said country to be the best military that they can be in their country. So we listen to the partner more. We want to know what they want to get out of the relationship and our presence in their country. We didn't necessarily do that in my experience in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Yeah. Yeah. So you're building more sustainable solutions for your partner forces.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's the idea of this integrated deterrence thing that like we're operating in an environment where we have a pacing threat in the region. Mm-hmm. So like, it's just like, you're building your team. Like they have a desire, they have a strategic desire of what they want to accomplish. And as long as that, or we can work with their, our strategic desires, this is that integrated deterrence. We're building a bigger team, hopefully to deter any sort of potential of us getting into a conflict scenario. So if we're thinking about that conflict continuum from competition to crisis, the bigger our team, maybe they don't want to do that because our team is so large.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it reminds me of when General Flynn came on Breaking Doctrine earlier this year. He was talking about the land power network. I have a question, too, about sustainability. So how do you maintain these relationships when we in the U.S. Army are rotating jobs every 2 to 3 years? But our partner forces might be in those positions for a lot longer than that.
Yeah, it's reputation. So that was the hardest thing for... I'll speak for all the SFABs, you know, to build that reputation inside of the area that we're working in. So when I was General Flynn's XO, 5th SFAB was new, but we had already started to build a good reputation inside of the Indo-Pacific. When I would sit down with heads of the Army, heads of the militaries in these countries we would travel to, they were always talking about, they would always ask about 5th SFAB and what they were doing in the country. So it's building that reputation and just maintaining that reputation. So it doesn't matter, you know, it does matter the face and the person that is sitting and, you know, talking with the partner, but it's the reputation of, you know, somebody who's wearing this patch inside of said country that matters the most. And that's how, you know, we have that continuity. We have a really good reputation now inside the Indo-Pacific.
And they know that we're going to be rotating through.
They do.
Yeah. Okay. And
it's the persistent species. Like it's, when it says it's the enterprise, like when they see the patch, like we know we are tailoring a force to meet their requested desired end state. So like when we come back to Malaysia, it may not be me as an engineer, but I am bringing something back to them that they, hey, we want to work on air assault or fires or logistics. They're bringing in expertise and we're paying forward, and it's that faith and it's that trust that we are in the enterprise itself.
Mm-hmm. I want to kind of keep the thread of relationship building or reputation about building interoperability. So could you show listeners how you build interoperability through the three domains that are in doctrine, the human, technical, and procedural?
Yeah. So human is that persistent presence and that day-to-day, you know, shoulder to shoulder with our partner, you know, conducting operations, advising them, et cetera. You know, but, you know, as Lieutenant Colonel Callahan was saying earlier, it's also the informal things, the dinners, the, you know, the lunches, the, you know, sweating in physical training together, those things, you know, build a better, stronger bond than the formal type of, hey, standing over the shoulder, advising them on, you know, you name it. The informal things get after the human dimension better. And that's why the persistent presence of being there and executing all of those informal type things really builds that human interoperability. Because you get to know one each other better, you know, asking those questions about family and, you know, background and stuff like that. So that really builds the human interoperability. The technical is the hardest one. We as a U.S. military struggle to do that, just in the Army, let alone across the joint force. So with our partners, you know, it is difficult, but we have made strides really in the past couple of years. Because when we talk about technical, at least in the Indo-Pacific, we generally talk about common operating picture. How do we get after, you know, if we are going to conflict tomorrow with a partner, how do we have a common operating picture for that operation? The movement to secure but unclassified encrypted environment that a lot of the Army is transitioning to, and we are in the Indo-Pacific, most of the divisions that operate out there are. That is allowing us to use our tactical advisor kit to develop these digital technical interoperability solutions with our partners. We've done it. The 25th Infantry Division has done it during the Joint Pacific Multinational Readiness Center, JPMRC rotations that they've done with several partners. And the 11th Airborne has experimented with that as well. We're starting another JPMRC rotation in Hawaii, and we'll be doing the same thing with, I believe it's 9 different multinational partners that we're going to have there. And then on the procedural interoperability, you know, with technical comes some procedural, but we had an exercise we had in Thailand. We had to develop a system to be able to deliver fires from U.S. assets, but through the partner. So we had to develop a procedure for the partner, their eyes on the ground, seeing a target, delivering that information back to a common operating picture, and then getting that information, you know, to the U.S. asset to deliver ammunition to a target. So those are the type of procedures that, you know, we work through in training that that will transfer over to crisis and conflict should we have to go there with that partner.
I think back to what you've prefaced of it's hard enough to do this with the U.S. force.
That's right. Very much so.
I can't even imagine, you know, different languages or English is your second language and that, you know, like all of the layers of difficulty on that.
Yeah. Interoperability is one thing we talk about all the time. We assess a partner. We usually do it across the three domains of interoperability because it's the easiest way to use common language for the Army to understand on how we are getting to an end state with a partner.
when we were in Malaysia, I mean, we spent significant amount of time through the gel process leading up to Kira Strike, like figuring out how we're going to communicate with their radios and our radios. And so like my team, like was in multiple planning events with Division S6, with the Malaysian Army Division S6 and 25th IDs, like their squadron S6, like figuring out how we're going to do that secure but secure communication, and like laying out where everything's going to be. And some of it was just swivel chair that we'd be just turning around and talking to that person next to us. Yeah. But in the same breath, we also were able to communicate at battalion level to battalion level that we were able to work towards that end state, so that there was some communication between different battalions in the same operation.
That just makes me like thankful that we have this opportunity, that we're not in conflict and trying to figure this out when it, you know, bullets are flying.
Yeah, which, you know, in the Korean conflict is where we really saw KMAG, the Korean Military Assistance Group, was stood up in 1949. And when the conflict started in 1950, they were the only active duty, the majority of the active duty army that was on the peninsula at the time. And they were spread out with different units. And they did, as I stated earlier, they were liaising, because everybody wanted information on what was happening on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were, you know, doing that liaise function initially, but then they were fighting and advising those units that they were assigned with on a day-to-day basis. And so that is really where we went from, competition quickly into crisis, into conflict there in the Korean Peninsula.
Let's shift kind of from more SFA specific to SFAB specific. So I already mentioned General Flynn. He came into Breaking Doctrine earlier this year, and he talked about how important your work was in the Indo-Pacific to build a land power network. So I'm curious to hear more details about your work in the region. I know you've talked a little bit already. ATP 3-96.1 outlines this mission cycle that you're doctrinally supposed to use. So I'm curious how you use that cycle and maintain proficiency in your SFA tasks while you have that persistent presence in Indo-PACOM.
Yeah. So we, in the Indo-Pacific, we are different than the other SFABs, and we operate on an 18-month cycle. So that is 6 months of individual training, 6 months of collective training, and then 6 months of employment in the theater. But each advisor in an SFAB gets a baseline of training. So we have the combat advisors training course, CAT-C, that each advisor attends at Fort Moore, Georgia, to get a baseline of security force assistance and how to learn how to be an advisor. We add to that in the 5th SFAB with Indo-Pacific specific things that they're going to encounter with our partners there, cultural things, all kinds of different things that is, you know, specific to the Indo-Pacific. Mm-hmm. But on those two training cycles before they employ, it's similar to any other organization in the Army, where, you know, it's baseline of weapon systems, communication systems. As the commander, our number one weapon system in the Indo-Pacific for 5th SFAB is our communications. So I'm definitely focused on ensuring every advisor knows how to operate a multitude of communication devices, because we don't carry weapons with us, you know, on a day-to-day. But if should we go to crisis or conflict, we do have our communication systems. And I go back to, you know, we're going to be asked a lot of information initially, liaising with our higher headquarters, providing them that information on what's going on the ground. So 6 months of individual, and then we transition to 6 months of collective. And the two main things that we do during the collective is we do a validating exercise. That is through in the Indo-Pacific. And then the other one is a mission readiness exercise. So we validate for combat, for conflict, during the validating exercise, and then we do a mission readiness exercise, which is going to validate that force package for competition. So what they're actually going to be doing when they get on the ground in whichever country they're going to.
I've noticed that both of you have used the word employment, but doctrine says deployment. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So the history behind it to me is when I became the commander, to get away from the Iraq-Afghanistan deployments that we were doing to a combat rotation. We say we employ because it's not a combat rotation that we're doing. So we employ our forces for 6 months instead of deploying them. It's a mindset type thing. I believe the previous SFAC commander, Major General Hill, wanted to get across to the command.
Yeah, just dropping one letter change. I mean, I can understand that, how it just changes your mindset. That's crazy.
Yeah.
I do want to add to something about the training and sort of like, how do we maintain consistent presence and train as well? Yeah. So we always have two battalions that are forward doing advising efforts that allows the other battalions to focus on the training cycle. So if you think about that 18-month cycle and we do it in sets of two, then it allows us to always have two, always have folks that are in specific countries consistent with that consistent presence, a permanent presence. And then it allows the rest of the team is back here to focus on training. So we're not trying to balance both the battalions themselves are not balancing forward efforts and rear efforts at the same time. So there's that balancing piece, and it allows us to focus on training when we're in training and focus on our employment and our advising efforts all simultaneously at the brigade level.
Yeah, I think maybe one piece just to make sure the audience is clear. So the SFABs are framed after the old brigade combat team concept. So six battalions, three maneuver, one fires, one engineer, and one sustainment. And then we build those into force packages. So one maneuver with one functional battalion, that's a force package. And so of the six battalions, two are partnered together for a force package, and then we rotate them through that 18-month cycle.
Okay. So if you're an advisor, is the ideal situation that you're doing two 18-month cycles?
Yes, that is the concept that we hire them against, is two 18-month cycles. Again, going back to the relationships and trust, building that trust. When you, as an advisor, you go back, even if you don't go back to the same country, but if you go back into the region and you have that experience from that previous employment, it's priceless. Like you just can't you can't train that experience that you get from employing into a country and then coming back a second time.
Makes sense.
I cannot agree more with that, because like even in my first employment, like I made mistakes. And so then on the second employment, now I have something to pull from. Like I spent so much time at the tactical level mentoring, partnering in the battalion and brigade and even at the division level, not realizing I still have other partners at the Ministry of Defense that I have to maintain and like maintain that connection, because that is the planning effort for following 2-3 force packages. Is like those relationship is not just at the tactical level, but it's at every level, sort of like the government. So you then go back to the Ministry of Defense. Okay, let's talk about what's next. Okay, what do you want to focus on? So there's learning that it's really hard to replicate in a VALX or an MRX about like where you should be spending your time as a leader in these countries.
I'd like to know your thought process and considerations of task organizing when you conduct SFA in so many countries across the Indo-Pacific.
So the joint exercise life cycle, the JELC process that we go through for exercises, that is where a lot of things that our partners want to get after, they come up through that process. There's also land force talks that we do with these countries that general officers participate in. But there's a governance process to how we get after what we're going to do in each country. It's not as simple as, hey, we just go sit with a partner and they say, hey, we want to work on, marksmanship training for all of our units. There is a very organized, higher echelon process that is gone through. And it is synchronized with the country team, what that country team sees for, the military inside that country. Indo-PACOM has a five-year plan for each country that is synchronized with the country team. And then USERPAC has that as well for the Army in each one of the countries. So, as that process works itself through, you know, that is where we come up with a plan for each one of the countries. So, operational design that we apply to each one of the countries is something that I have focused on since I've been in command, because we really didn't, we had those processes were in place, but it really didn't work itself down to what was being executed on the ground. And that's, I can let Lieutenant Colonel Callahan talk about that a little bit more. How does that, the bigger picture stuff work itself down to what they execute on the day-to-day?
Yeah.
The engineer advising is made up of three different teams. So each team goes to different countries. So what an individual country desires to work on that's come through all of these working groups and these land force talks, then comes out and says, okay, you have an agreed to training activity that you're going to work on. Well, I may not have that expertise. And so there's either two major ways that we try to get after those expertise that they've asked for. And that's one, you task organize your team, you build a team to support those requirements so that I may augment a team with bringing in fires assets. And there are teams that they can then move around between different countries for a very specific time to come into Malaysia or come into Mongolia to say, okay, we're going to focus on fires with a specific unit or an institution or logistics. So there's those two different ways that we get after their desired end state that we've talked about through land force talks, is either task organizing a team to meet those requirements or having an episodic engagement come in that focuses on something they specifically wanted to talk about. So in my time when I was in Malaysia, they wanted to talk about air assault operations. So we were working to bring in a maneuver team for a two-week period to lead a subject matter exchange so that they were more capable leading into Operation Pathways.
So Operation Pathways is the USERPAC's way of campaigning in the Pacific. So it is a combination of about 40 different exercises over the calendar year, both joint and army to army, that happen in the Indo-Pacific in multiple countries. There's some long-standing ones that we do in say Thailand and Indonesia and Korea. All of those combination of those exercises is Operation Pathways.
And I'll add even more so as being an advisor, you may be asked to do things that are outside your specific expertise. And getting into doctrine and studying and preparing is just part of what it takes to be an advisor. They may ask questions that are not, my team of four, I don't have an expert in communications. So I spent a lot of time either phoning a friend or cracking the book to study to make sure that I understood what they wanted to get to and sure that my voiceover, my lexicon is aligned with U.S. doctrine. So when the next unit comes in, it's the same things or hearing the same things because it's based in an understanding that the entire Army operates off of.
Yeah, that's great. Instead of using the TTPs or the way you did things. Yeah.
The doctrine is the base. It has to be the base because I may not go back to Malaysia or my team may not go back to Mongolia. But if we always stick to that as an underlying theme, then whatever team flows in behind us, they know they're going to get the same sort of wording, the same references. It's always going to be the same thing.
And that goes back to what we talked about earlier with the reputation. And you can maintain a reputation if you're on the same sheet of music.
That's essential. When I was working with my team or even in Mongolia or wherever they were, it's you can't go off the hip. It has to be based off of something that has been proven and it's usually published in some sort of doctrine. And then we can help them set up their SOPs and help them set up TTPs for what works in their operating environment. But it has to be based in what we've been taught in the Army, because if we're working shoulder to shoulder, we want them to be sort of thinking how our doctrine is aligned.
And that's, and we're talking staff sergeants and sergeant first classes that have to dig in and understand these things. And that's the benefit of serving in an SFAB, no matter which SFAB it is. The NCO or the officer that serves there is going to be, when they come out of that, that tour with an SFAB, they're going to be much more doctrinally proficient. They're, the experiences that they have working with these partners all over the world is just going to build them into a different type of NCO or officer. And that's what we give back to the Army, is just a much better you know, NCO and officer to serve in units throughout the Army.
It's like that saying, if you want to learn something, become a teacher. If you want to learn doctrine, become an SFAB.
Yeah.
One of the first things that I did in Malaysia, they asked me to discuss our operations process. So like I had to take 3-0 and like break it down for like an LPD for the like a division leaders and be able to talk it from beginning to end and like answer questions. So the amount of hours I spent prepping for an hour and a half discussion was significant. And so it made me much better down the road when we started talking 390. I could always go back and reference, well, this is how it nests into the operations.
Now, you know, you just plugged how awesome it is to be an advisor. Let's talk about what those folks, our listeners, who will never be an advisor, what else should they know about your organization? And how might, even though they're not an advisor, how might the SFA work impact them?
Yeah, so in Indo-Pacific, you know, I mentioned Operation Pathways. So those, you know, the three divisions and the multitude of separate brigades that take part in that, you know, the 25th Infantry Division, the 7th Infantry Division, and the 11th Airborne Division. As those divisions and brigades come into those exercises, before they even come, we are speaking with them. We are usually helping to train whichever partner they're going to be with during that operation before they arrive. And so we will liaise, you know, with that unit and, you know, give them cultural, atmospherics, partner specifics for, say, it's a, you know, they're going to partner with this battalion for, you know, Operation Pathways. We will tell them, hey, we've trained them on these things. Here's their strengths. Here's their weaknesses. You know, here's some things that you can carry forward as this exercise continues on. So although they will never be part of an SFAB, we are there helping to support operations they're going to be doing with the partners in the region.
And I'll add to it is like the way I described it to some other people who are asking me is a lot of times we're a lubricant between these two large organizations because we have access to so many different leaders and we've developed trust with so many different leaders. So when they come in and ask them questions about like, hey, we need to do a recon of a port in Sabah, or we need to like get customs worked out in this small airport in this local area. Like I already have the people that work at this division or core level that then we walk over and we say, okay, hey, I need to schedule an Army engineers to do some sort of port recon. So that access and that lubricant between these two large organizations helps us become more efficient and accomplish more when we get to the operations pathways because we're so much more focused on the training and not all the other things in the surrounding behind the scenes.
Yeah, gotcha. Anything that I missed about the SFAB? Any other parting comments that you have, gentlemen?
I will say that if, you know, people that are interested in serving in an SFAB, like it's not all just these things that we're talking about, you know, working with the partner day to day. You know, that is obviously the mission and that's, you know, what we're built in to do. But getting to serve in these countries and again, across the world, five different SFABs, active duty, and experiencing the cultures there. So, you know, we're not working 24/7 every day. They get to spend some free time experiencing those countries. And so, you know, when they're in the country working with the partner, but then free time, they get to explore that country and go and see these different places. And so that is an added benefit of service in an SFAB as well.
It's an employment, not a deployment.
That's right. It's an employment, not a deployment. Yeah, probably not staying in a tent.
Thanks, gentlemen, for coming on the show.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. It's great.
Just like writing new doctrine is a team effort, breaking doctrine takes a team. Without the Kurin Special Doctrine Division here at CAD, we wouldn't be able to bring you this show. Our production is coordinated by Mr. Ted Crisco, and our editing and sound is provided by Mr. Zarek Fry from 29 Pixel Studios. Please don't forget to subscribe on Amazon Music, Apple, Odyssey, Audible, Spotify, or YouTube. Also, go ahead and follow us on social media at U.S. Army Doctrine to get updates on new podcasts, Doctrine Digest videos, and publications. Finally, the views and opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the official position of the United States Army, the U.S. Army Training and Doctrine Command, or the Combined Arms Center. I'm Lieutenant Colonel Lisa Becker, and this has been Breaking Doctrine.